Chapter 18. The Red Button. Computer hackers. There are half a dozen computers in the room, linked to other machines with a tangle of wires that mirrors the chaos in the upper floors. The equipment manages to be old-fashioned and sophisticated at the same time, with plain metal cases bolted together, row upon row of USB sockets at the end of cables that sprout in all directions. No logos that look remotely like an apple or a four-coloured square. In the very centre of it all, there's a red button which is almost laughable. There's something of the circus about it, or a magic trick. A single wire connects it to some sort of transmitting device. It's as if two different centuries have been joined together, one at each end of the wire. There are no windows in the room. Neon strips provide the lighting. And as a doctor, John would imagine the occupant suffering migraines and asthenopia after only a short time in this unhealthy environment. The cigarette smoke won't help either. Three men are sitting on either side of a square metal table, crouched over their monitors. A fourth chair is empty. He recognizes Dominic and Guillaume. They're not wearing robes, but torn jeans and t-shirts. Guillaume is smoking a cigarette. In the background, a digital clock is counting the hours, minutes, and seconds, the flickering neon adding to the unpleasant lighting effect. It is 10:42. The final digit changes as John watches. 10:43. The seconds rush past, starting again at 00. A television screen takes up almost all the far wall, showing live images of an underground railway station with an extraordinary ultra-modern train stretching into the distance. The train is a world apart from the metal beasts John saw at Victoria Station. It's surrounded by engineers in grey overalls who seem to be finishing their checks, packing away their things. John notices a figure walking towards the camera and flinches. It is Jonathan Blore, the man who tried to kidnap Holmes at Paddington Cemetery. Holmes has seen him too. Something dangerous flickers briefly in his eyes, and although John says nothing, he will have reason to remember this moment very soon. On the screen, lights are flashing as the train doors prepare to close automatically. The platform is beginning to empty. Just glimpsed by the hidden camera, Jonathan Blore climbs on board. He will be making the journey alone, heading for his graveyard shift. "All done," Dominic says. "Anything from Biogenesis?" Guillaume is also wearing headphones. "Radio silence," he announces. "Their cameras are still down."
"It's deliberate," Dominic mutters. "He don't want anyone watching." He gives a sniff of laughter. "Maybe we'll send the footage to their business partners when this is all over. These people are worse crooks than us." So there's the link.
They have found the red circle, and Holmes was right. They were blackmailing Dost Akbar, and it would seem they were also targeting Biogenesis. What was it Missy was saying as they came down the stairs? "Do you know how many people are going to die?" John remembers the plane that came down on Richmond Park, and he has no doubt at all that this train is their next target. The only thing is, he can't see any passengers. What did she mean? And there is Missy. His heart leaps as he sees her at the side of the room, sitting in a chair with her hands behind her. They must be tied. She is pale, and there is a swelling under one of her eyes, but otherwise she seems unhurt. He wants to rush over to her, but waits to see how Holmes is going to play this. He has the weapon. Holmes has the strategy. Grimly, it occurs to him that they make a good team. Missy sees them, and although she manages to prevent herself from crying out, her eyes widen. It is a mistake. Dominic notices her surprise and twists round. He sees the two intruders, and at once his hand is scrabbling for something on the table. John steps forward before he can find it, his own gun raised. "Nobody move," he says. Dominic, Guillaume, and the third man freeze. Missy squirms in her seat but can't rise.
"They're going to blow up the train," she cries. "They're going to bring down the shard. They're monsters."
"Set her free, Sherlock." John is both giving the orders and using Holmes's Christian name for the first time.
To John's surprise, Holmes obeys, hurrying over to Missy.
Are you all right? John calls out to her. They haven't hurt me.
I can't free her, Holmes says. They've used handcuffs. He glances at the three men. Has anyone got the key? Or a paperclip will do. The three computer hackers, terrorists, fake priests, John is unsure what to call them, have not moved. They are sitting in their places, rigid. But as the shock of Holmes's appearance wears off, they try to regain control of the situation. Dominic is the first to speak.
£20,000 to walk out of this room and leave us alone, he says.
Holmes makes no reply.
£50,000, then.
You want to get out of the squalor of London?
We can make you seriously rich.
Just for turning a blind eye? Holmes asks.
It'll be in your account. Instantly.
I can do it from here. What have you got to lose?
Well, my reputation for a start, Holmes responds. I'm not sure I should be taking the side of criminals.
We're not criminals. They are.
Dominic points at the screen.
Biogenesis is just one of the multinationals screwing the planet, bribing the politicians, ripping off the people in every country where they're active.
Do you know what they're doing in agriculture, in pharma, in industry, and in healthcare? They're redesigning the world not to make it better, but to make themselves richer. They're creating new pathogens. They're the masters of biodegradation and biodeterioration, destroying what exists so that they can sell us their own patented alternatives. They're creating living organisms out of synthetic chemicals. How long before their own creatures are superior to human beings and we find ourselves subservient to them?
But you're not fighting them, John exclaims, standing with his back to the staircase, the one way out.
You're just stealing from them.
We're showing them that they're not quite the master race that they think they are.
The other two men have said nothing while Dominic has spoken. Guillaume has sat in sullen silence. The third man, a few years younger than Dominic and similar in appearance, has allowed his hand to stray across the table, disappearing behind one of the boxes. John fires. The sound of the bullet is incredibly loud in this claustrophobic underground space. It strikes the surface of the table an inch away from the gun that the man was reaching for, and with a bright orange spark, ricochets into the wall.
Push it away from you, John warns him.
Do as he says, Sam. Dominic's voice remains calm, measured. Throw down the gun, a fourth voice commands.
The words are addressed to John Watson. And at the same time, he feels something hard and cold being pressed into the back of his head. A wave of dismay and self-disgust courses through him.
Three people, four chairs.
One of them was outside the room and has now returned, creeping down the stairs just as he and Holmes did a few minutes before. He tries to turn his head to catch sight of his attacker, but although, out of the corner of his eye, he can make out one arm, short sleeves, very dark skin, he is not allowed to do more. The man's gun jabs into his skull, hurting him.
Do as I say, you bastard, or I'm going to kill you in front of your friends.
Do it, John, Holmes urges. John glances in his direction. He knows that if he loses the weapon, they are all doomed. Could he take out Dominic even at the expense of his own life? Could he fire a bullet into the main computer and hope to save 1,000 Londoners?
What would Holmes do?
But Holmes is not looking at him. His eyes are cast down, focused on an area of the floor close to him. Throw down the gun, he urges.
John understands.
All right, he says. Let's try and stay calm.
He holds out the revolver, his finger off the trigger, then throws it down towards the floor, exactly where Holmes was indicating.
As fast as a cat, Holmes dives forward, catches the gun, and fires all in one movement.
John didn't even realize he knew how to use a firearm, but it's as neat a piece of stunt work as he has ever seen. Holmes's bullet, fired with John's revolver, flies over John's head, perilously close, and hits the man who came in behind him. The man cries out and staggers backwards. John twists round and falls on him, grabbing his gun. The man is an African,
dressed in a brightly coloured short-sleeved shirt and jeans. In the station, he went by the name of Arden Dow. With his work complete, he had returned to Baker Street just in time to steal up on Watson from behind. Now he is lying on his back. Blood is oozing out of a wound in his shoulder, and his eyes are glazed with shock. And that should be the end of it. They have won, against all the odds, haven't they? But when John gets to his feet, holding the African man's gun, he sees that once again the situation has changed. The third member of the team, the one called Sam, has moved with lightning speed. He has snatched his own weapon and has grabbed hold of Missy. He has a gun to her head. Stretched out on the floor after his own trick shot, there is nothing Holmes can do. Watson is in front of the stairway. Both of them are armed, but if they try anything, Missy will be the first to die. "I'm getting a little tired of this," Dominic announces. He produces his own gun, drawing it out of his waistband where it has been lurking all along. "I'm going to count to three. You will both drop your weapons and sit down on your hands. If you try anything else, I will kill your friend and I'll make sure the bullet goes somewhere that really hurts." "Don't listen to him," Missy cries out. "They're going to blow up the train. They're going to kill hundreds of people. You've got to stop them."
"One?"
John looks to Holmes. Behind him, Arden is groaning, trying to sit up.
"Two?"
Holmes makes his decision. He lowers his gun. He is already on the floor. For the first time, there is defeat in his eyes. It's over. Or so John believes. The explosion of the front door of the house being smashed off its hinges echoes down the stairs and into the room. Dominic's head swings round, his attention momentarily diverted from Missy. In that brief second, Holmes lifts his gun again and shoots him between the eyes. The stamp of footsteps clang out on the metal stairs. A single word is shouted. "Police!" They have heard the gunshot. They are rushing down to the basement. On the screen, the maglev train begins to move. The digital clock shows 11 a.m. Guillaume makes his move. He throws himself forward, his splayed hand stretching towards the red button. He doesn't care that it's all over for him and his co-conspirators. He will take Biogenesis and the Shard with him, go out in a blaze of hellish glory. Sherlock is ahead of him. He throws himself onto Guillaume, grabs his wrist, and drags him back. For a brief moment, the hand hovers over the button. Then they swing round. Guillaume is the larger of the two, but it turns out that Holmes can also add unarmed combat to his store of hidden skills. He follows an elbow strike with a savage blow, driving the edge of his hand into Guillaume's throat. Guillaume goes down, gasping. Lestrade bursts into the room. Hopkins is a few steps behind him. There are another four police officers with them, all armed, almost too many of them to fit into the room. And now, at last, it is game over. Dominic is dead. Guillaume and Arden are incapacitated. Sam is sitting with his hands in the air, a look of abject misery on his face. The red circle has been broken.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
Lestrade asks Holmes, the first of about 50 questions that are whirling through his mind.
"All three of you."
"Perhaps you'd be good enough to find the key and release Missy," John says. "She's handcuffed to that chair." "I'm onto it." Hopkins hurries forwards. Two police officers drag Sam to his feet. Lestrade looks at him.
"Harry Webb, I presume," he says.
"I'm Samuel. Harry's dead. He shot him." Sam Webb looks balefully at Holmes.
"I'm sorry," Holmes replies. He sounds completely sincere. "He was going to hurt Missy."
"Get him out of here," Lestrade orders, "and the other two. Looks like they need a doctor. And someone bring down a body bag for Harry Webb." He looks about him in disbelief. "I hope you can explain all this," he says to Holmes.
"It's very simple, Chief Inspector," Holmes replies. "They were planning to blow up a train."
"Their target was Biogenesis," John adds. "Blackmail," Lestrade says, but taken to new depths of depravity. He examines the TV screen. It looks as if the train has gone.
It'll be well out of London by now, John says.
I found them, Hopkins exclaims. He has the keys. He crouches down behind Missy, and a moment later she is rising out of her seat.
John assumes she will want to thank Holmes, but he is pleasantly surprised when she crosses the room and throws her arms around his neck.
I was so hoping you'd come, she says. She kisses him, and John feels a rush of happiness, a moment of pure joy that takes him quite by surprise.
Right then, everything that surrounds him, the police, the crime scene, the men being carried out, alive or dead, seems to disappear, and he is aware only of a future filled with possibilities.
I helped a bit too, Holmes mutters, blithely shattering the spell.
It takes a while for the wounded men and the dead one to be removed from the room, but finally it is time to go. The screen shows an empty station. The computers sit, a few tiny lights blinking as if in dismay. Only Lestrade and Hopkins, Holmes, Watson and Missy are left in the room.
I think it's time to go, Lestrade says. You've forgotten something, Holmes says. There is a faraway look in his eyes that makes John feel uneasy.
He is gazing at the computer screen.
What? Lestrade asks.
Blore. Who is Blore?
He is the devil. Holmes takes a step towards the computers and reaches out.
No!
John shouts. Before anyone can move, Holmes punches the red button.
Jonathan Blore is sitting in a carriage surrounded by boxes, watching the English countryside rush past. The train is ploughing through the middle of nowhere, although it's possible that the building he can see in the far distance is the Cathedral of St. Albans. His mouth is dry, but there will be no drink service on this train. There isn't even a driver. A computer program is taking him to the misery that will be the rest of his life. He should have known. Nobody fails Mycroft.
So it might even come as a relief when the 6 thermobaric bombs are detonated simultaneously. Perhaps the flash of brilliant white light will have come as a moment of enlightenment. If so, it will not have lasted very long, as Blore's death is instantaneous, incinerated and blown to smithereens at the same time. Not a molecule of him will ever be found. The same is more or less true for the servers. All the information that Biogenesis has stored over the years, all its research, its findings, its financial records, its HR and accounting systems, are evaporated, scattered over the surrounding fields. The explosion is seen as far away as Luton. A pillar of smoke looms over the shattered railway like a biblical judgment. Only Blore dies. Nobody else is hurt.
Why? Lestrade asks.
2 days have passed, and he is sitting in a public house in Dorset Street, just round the corner from Missy's home. The Barley Mow is a handsome, old-fashioned place, more restrained than many of the other pubs in the area. Missy Hudson sometimes came here with Finn. Now she is sitting at a table with her 2 lodgers and the 2 police officers. 4 of them are sharing a bottle of wine. Sherlock Holmes has orange juice.
I know it was wrong of me, and I'm sorry, but they were bad people, Holmes replies.
You don't know that.
But I do. Jonathan Blore laid a trap for us at Paddington Cemetery. He would have killed John and taken me. I'd met him before.
Was he the man who attacked you at the Thames?
No, it was before that. He was part of Biogenesis. I don't regret what I did, Chief Inspector. The world is better off without them.
People could have been killed.
But they weren't.
How did you find us, Chief Inspector?
John can see that Holmes is uncomfortable and deliberately changes the subject.
Well, Dr. Watson, it was just a case of putting 2 and 2 together. We went to see Mr. Blore at Biogenesis, and you're certainly right about one thing. It was a nasty piece of work. But it was when he took our phones and put them in a lead-lined box that the penny dropped. There was a case a while back. Harry and Samuel Webb. They were brothers working out of a flat in Canary Wharf. Their game was pretty much the same as this time round, demanding money with menaces.
But we've interviewed the three surviving members of the Red Circle and we've worked a few things out. They weren't quite so clever then. First of all, although it was the same deal, pay us or we'll destroy your business, they only targeted single individuals, and the payment was a one-off, £1 million. That wasn't such an easy sell, and they were stupid. A flat in Canary Wharf. It had phone lines, electricity, local rates, a postcode. In the end, it wasn't hard to track them down, and the two brothers ended up in jail. But when they came out, they'd learnt their lesson, and this time they were much more careful. First of all, they needed a safe space. They had to go off-grid. And what's the safest place to hide out in London? A house that doesn't exist, Holmes says. Exactly right. That was their big idea. They bought half of 221 Baker Street and half of 223, and they built what you might call an invisible house between the two of them, stealing one room here and another there, part of the attic and all of the basement. They generated their own electricity, and they had their own telecoms. They paid off Finn and Silas Welburn with money they'd got left over from their past crimes, and all would have been well. Except that Silas Welburn decided to try blackmailing them. Holmes breaks in. There is a certain irony, don't you think? The blackmailer's blackmailed by another blackmailer, Lestrade mutters. But you'll remember what your soldier friend Victor Lynch told us at the Dorchester Hotel, Watson. He said that Silas Welburn had been rich once and that he'd had a house...
In Canary Wharf,
Watson exclaims. Precisely. He also said that he had become irritated by the noise made by the chanting, that he had persuaded Silas to go next door to complain. It was from that moment that relations between the two of them deteriorated. My guess is that Welburn had seen Harry and Samuel Webb, as we must now refer to them, in Canary Wharf and recognised them. He realised what they were doing and demanded money to keep quiet. So they killed him. Unfortunately, there was an unintended consequence to Welburn's actions. Harry Webb, Dominic, as he called himself, was suddenly nervous. What would happen if his other neighbour tried the same thing? That was why he was so determined to buy 221 Baker Street.
For his own safety, Missy says.
Exactly. And at the expense of yours.
So what will happen now?
John asks. Lestrade takes over. Well, 221B could be torn down as an illegal construction, but what's more likely, under the Criminal Compensation Act, is that it will be confiscated and handed over to the police. We can probably arrange for your old rooms to be handed back to you, Mrs. Hudson.
My house is big enough as it is, Missy says.
It needs a surgery, Holmes suggests.
Well, that's true, Missy smiles. Let me know if there's any news, Chief Inspector.
Hopkins raises his glass of wine.
Well, that's something rare in this godforsaken city, he announces. A happy ending.
But it's not quite ended yet.